Well, it was probably 2 months ago that life seemed pretty normal, that we were going about our business and doing the regular activities, and we're pretty comfortable with that. But then when this COVID-19 came through, it literally changed everything on a global matter. We have changed our lifestyles. There's people who have actually passed away because they are vulnerable to this. I actually heard word this week that there was a member of our own congregation who's officially been diagnosed with COVID-19. So it's touching all areas of our life, and whether you have lost your job or it's been cut back, there's changes that we have to deal with. And so the fact that God is a refuge is critically important, that we draw on His presence and His strength in the midst of all these things that are happening. This morning we're going to spend time in Romans 9, 22 through 23. When we begin to look at life and how much it has changed, it reminds us how vulnerable we actually are. We kind of go through life with this sense of invincibility because we live in the richest country in the world. We are individuals who feel like life is pretty good, and we worry about luxuries, not even our basic needs. But these kinds of changes that have happened to us may seem like it came out of a fiction novel. It sounds like something that we would never have to deal with in terms of our life, and yet it has. And so one of the things that we are going to deal with is something that may sound like fiction, but is actually real. And we want to deal with it as we walk through these texts. A couple of them we have looked at before, but we're going to begin by reading Romans 9, 22 through 29, and just kind of refreshing ourselves in the text and then looking at some fundamental issues here that need to touch our lives in terms of the big picture. I know we're somewhat overwhelmed by the circumstances that we face, but we need to keep looking at life from eternity. Begins in Romans 9, 22. What if God, desiring to show His wrath and to make known His power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, in order to make known the riches of His glory for vessels of mercy, which He has prepared beforehand for glory, even us whom He has called? Not from the Jews only, but also from the Gentiles. As indeed He says in Hosea, those who were not My people I will call My people, and her who was not beloved I will call beloved, and in the very place where it was said to them, you are not My people, there they will be called sons of the living God. And Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will be saved. For the Lord will carry out His sentence upon the earth fully and without delay. And as Isaiah predicted, if the Lord of hosts had not left us an offspring, we would have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. Now, being that it's my birthday, I don't like bringing bad news, but that's just part of the equation of what we have to deal with here. The idea I want you to guess here is the idea of the riches of God's glory, and that God is in a rescue mission to save a remnant of humanity to avoid extinction. That God is in a rescue mission that is rescuing a remnant of humanity to avoid extinction. Now, that may sound fairly dramatic. I went back and found Lord Byron's poem, Don Juan, from 1823, and he is the one that's basically been credited with the idea that truth is stranger than fiction. And it may feel that way today as we walk through this text. The poem says this, "'Tis strange but true, for truth is always strange, stranger than fiction, if it could be told.'" How much would novels gain by the exchange? How different the world would men behold? How oft would vice and virtue places change? The new world would be nothing to the old. If some Columbus of the moral seas would show mankind their souls' antipodes. Now, you may not catch the old English, but the idea is that he's trying to advocate that, especially on a moral level, that the battle that goes on inside of our lives, often sometimes it's fiction. We believe and set moral standards based on fiction, but the reality is that the truth is what needs to guide our lives. As I think about that, I think about movies. I love watching different kinds of movies, and my wife does too. The difference is that my wife loves Hallmark. I love adventure movies. We've sat through lots of Hallmark, so I have to confess, even if it's, I'm 60, and it's not because I'm losing my mind, I have watched a number of Hallmark movies, and that's what we do together. I watch more adventure movies, and the ones that I kind of were thinking about this morning is the ones that basically have put humanity at extinction-level situations. For instance, you deal with movies like Deep Impact or Armageddon or Battleship or the Avenger movies, which basically all have humanity at jeopardy at some point. The movie Edge of Tomorrow or Independence Day. What they all share in common is sort of these extinction-level events that is going to wipe out all of humanity. And it's fun to watch them. They're extremely entertaining, but we all recognize the fact that Hollywood has a great imagination, and what they put out most of the time is just fictional entertainment. But what is strange for us, but what is fiction for Hollywood, often we need to think about that there's a certain reality that we have to deal with in our world that sounds like fiction but is actually true. And that fiction, that reality that we deal with is the reality that sin is jeopardizing the human existence to the point of extinction. And if it isn't dealt with, the only end results is that the extinction or the elimination of humanity. Now, you may not think of it that way, and it may seem strange, but we want to begin in verses 22 and 23 to look at some of the truth and some of the things that sound like fiction, beginning with the fact of who God is. One of the things we have to remind ourselves is God is for us. I mean, after all, he is the creator of the universe. He is the one that created male and female, man and woman, Adam and Eve in the garden, which for many people they simply write off as fiction. This is just sort of philosophical myth. But the truth is God created them and he put his own image and imprinted it on their existence. So we have the capacity to relate to one another as human beings, to think, to have rational thought, to be aware of our own existence. We have a moral disposition that tells us things are right and wrong. All those things become a reflection of the fact that God has created us. But the other part of God's divine purpose includes the freedom that man had to choose. And we understand theologically that man fell from that grace. We call it the fall of humanity. And that fallenness was the disobedience of Adam and Eve that threw basically everyone under a bus. And it did so in such a way that it had cataclysmic effects over all of God's creation and placed us in a position that we live at odds with God. And literally, God has the right, and he has the righteous obligation, as it were, that his wrath needs to be upon all of humanity. That we are in a position of extinction before a holy God. He has every right to destroy us. And from his divine perspective, we have no hope. We cannot save ourselves. And so we are told that even though God is for us, we are facing this bizarre, almost fictitious idea that God is also against us. That God, if he's going to be true to his character, has the absolute right, he has the absolute obligation, if he's going to be a righteous God, to judge that which is sinful and evil. And so even in the beginning of time, before our existence, we find ourselves that God is for us, but God is also our antagonist. He is the one that, if he is consistent, will judge us because of our fallenness. Now, that may feel morally wrong to us, and primarily because we have this disposition as human beings to say we are basically good. And if God is really a God of love, we're doing the best that we can. We know we lived in a mess-up world. We know that we're not perfect. So if God's going to give us anything of the benefit of the doubt, he should see us as basically good as well. Now, part of the problem, obviously, is that we don't see the horror of our sin, regardless of how small we make it, compared to a holy God. And so as we begin to think through this, I want to propose to you that God is on a rescue mission to save a remnant of humanity so that we don't become extinct. Now, I do want to qualify one theological thing that many of you may not know about, but there is a certain theology that says that when people die, it's unjust for God to punish them for the rest of eternity. And so it's a theory called annihilationism, that God will punish them for a while and then they will just cease to exist. Not convinced it's a biblical position at all. There's nothing that would suggest that. That's simply our sort of moral indignation to think that God would punish people for all eternity for rejecting him. But the reality of Scripture is that in the same way that we will live forever in the presence of God, that people will be sent apart from God for the rest of their existence. And we need to feel the weight of that because we're dealing with life and death. We're dealing with the extinction of humanity if God doesn't do something, and he is not only for us, but he's also the one that is against us. Now, in the same way that our whole life has been disrupted by this COVID-19, I will propose to you that there is an invisible enemy, and I, for the lack of better terms, I'm going to call it a spiritual COVID-19 disease called sin. It just will not take some lives. It is committed to taking every life. The fact that all of us will face physical death, and it's unavoidable, means that we are all subject to extinction. We are all subject to perishing. In fact, John 3:16 reiterates this. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. And so the status of humanity is one of perishing. It's one of destruction. I mean, if you look at some of these passages that are part of this text, it becomes very obvious that God is against us in some respects. It uses terms like God desires to execute his wrath, but he has patience. He has this enduring patience, which basically means to put up with annoyance or difficulty. It's almost like God is restraining himself from inflicting his wrath upon humanity. There's other terms that are used in here. It refers to individuals as vessels of destruction. And all of this says that we have an enemy that's far greater than Satan in some respect, and it's God. Now that's going to sound almost heretical. The reality is that God is the creator of everything and has the right to judge evil. And so we understand that from this text, if you look at verse 23, that God is not only against us in some ways, but he's also for us. And he tells us about that he's going to display the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy. Now for us, and what Paul's doing is that he's looking at it from the perspective of the gospel. The good news that there is one singular solution to the reality of our problem, that we are sinners, that we are under God's wrath, and that we're in a position of extinction as human beings, as a human race, if it isn't for God's rescue plan. And so he goes on and talks about this as he moves through the text. If you look at verse 9:24, he makes this statement about God's compassion. Even us, these mercy, the riches of his glory is going to be poured out on these vessels of mercy, even us whom he has called. Now, Paul is speaking, and he says, not from the Jews only, but also from the Gentiles. Now, the amazing thing is that God is going to extend his mercy. He's going to extend his rescue mission, not just with the Jews, not just with this one singular ethnic group, but he's now going to open the door so that non-Jews can become recipients of this rescue mission. And so God isn't just, he's not got sort of this prejudicial desire, he's only going to rescue one kind of people because they're superior. God has chosen to give them benefits no other nation has. They are the ones that have the promises, they are the ones that have the covenants, they are the one that the Messiah is going to descend from. They are the apple of God's eye. They are a chosen race. But in the absolute mercy of God, he then decides through his son that he will actually open it up the door to this rescue mission to those who are Gentiles, or basically those who are non-Jews. And so we have to consider that the reality that God has saved us is an extraordinary act of his mercy and compassion that is completely undeserved, is completely unmerited, and there's nothing that we can do to save ourselves. Now, it sounds particular, but when you look at this, Paul sort of states this scenario that God is both for us and against us, and then he wants to prove to us, as he goes back in history, to show how God has acted this way, even with his own people. So when you get to Romans 9:24, he actually quotes Hosea chapter 2 and Hosea chapter 1. He talks about God's mercy to rebellious Israel, and he wants to show that God can both be, and as it were, the protagonist and the antagonist all at the same time. He's for us, and yet he is our worst enemy. Israel has gone through some very difficult situations, and if we read the text, you will notice that he says, I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved one. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people, and they will say, you are my God. That's a reference to Israel. And literally the problem is that as Paul guides us historically through the prophets, he wants us to show that how God deals with his own people. They had become so rebellious, so sinful, that their sin basically outstripped the nations around them. And God had to deal with this on occasion with his own people, because he is basically saying, when he says, you are not my people, God's coming to the point where he's saying, there isn't anything that these people are doing that reflects me. There isn't any way that these people are acting that reflects my character and my heart and my passion and my righteousness and my holiness. There's nothing. They've literally abandoned, like, as if they were never my people, and that's what God is saying here. But God chooses, in light of the fact that he has right to decimate all of them, and there's times through biblical history you'll see that God does this with Noah. He wipes out all of humanity except for a small handful of people. God has at times brought great discipline to the world, and why some people struggle so much with the Old Testament is because they see God as wrathful and he's angry and he's destroying people groups all the time. Well, part of the problem is that we don't see the magnitude and the horror of our sinfulness, and yet God does, and he has every right to discipline and try to call his people back to repentance. And so as we look at this, the statement really continues if you look at the next statement. Though your people will be like the sand of the sea, Israel, only a remnant will return. Destruction has been decreed, overwhelming and righteous. The Lord Almighty, will carry out the destructive decree upon the whole land. So God has disciplined his own people by allowing another nation to conquer them and carry them off into exile. And this happened in several different kinds of scenarios. But it was all in response to the sinfulness of his people. And if he dealt with his own people that way, he has even more reason to deal with those who've outright rejected him. And so the context is profound. Isaiah 10:5, God's impending judgment on the Assyrians, who he actually used to discipline Israel. He says, they were the rod of my anger and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. He used the Assyrians as an instrument of discipline of his own people, and then was going to turn around and discipline them because their attack on their people was horrifically evil. And so it creates this dilemma in our thinking, is that if God is for us and he's against us, how do I find refuge? How do I find security and be part of the remnant that God's going to save? I mean, do I have to earn it? What do I have to do different? How do I be better at what I'm doing? And the problem is, in many ways, it's difficult. When you and I think of a remnant, this last year I had some people do a shower renovation upstairs. We tore it all out, rebuilt the walls, put new sheetrock on, and did it all up, and then we had a guy come in and put brand new tile into it, and we put new fixtures. Well, we had remnants left over, but the remnants in those kinds of situations when you're doing house renovations are just leftover pieces that you discard because you cut those away because they don't fit the mold. But when we're thinking about the idea of biblical remnant, we're looking at people that are the few remnants that are left over after the other people are gone, but they're not the ones you discard, it's the one that God collects. It's those are the ones that are precious in God's sight that he collects around him, because these are the ones that often are the ones that repent, the ones who are committed to seeking righteousness, to admitting their sin, who will finally rely on God and not their own devices. They will seek and worship him alone and not allow a lot of other idols into their life. And so these are the ones, when he talks about this, that basically says of all the people of Israel, all that's going to be saved is a remnant. A few pick-me-ups, a few individuals who have survived this onslaught of God's discipline and his wrath, and that's all that's left. And just so that we sort of understand the intensity of God's wrath, and when you get to Romans 9:28, he says, "For the Lord will carry out his sentence on earth with speed and finality." Now, it's odd that Paul is quoting this in this context, but he wants to remind these people that God is for us, but God is also the one who's against us, that he is in this, he is obligated by his righteousness that he's going to destroy. He's going to pour out his wrath on evil and sin, and yet he's also the advocate that's providing the rescue to save a remnant of people. Why? Because people don't want to have anything to do with God. They want to chart their own course. They want to be self-sufficient. They don't want anyone telling them what to do. They're going to make life their legacy. They're going to accomplish their goals. They're going to prove to their parents they are significant. They're going to do whatever it takes to prove their sense of worth. And when it comes to God, it's a futile attempt. I love the statement, "A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return." A very few of all of God's chosen people, and it's a theme that Paul's going to talk about all the way through here. And so the reprieve of God's mercy, if you get down to verse 29, he sort of puts this as the punctuation mark to help us feel the weight, the fact that all of humanity is on a pathway to extinction except for those that are rescued. And the numbers that are going to be rescued, regardless of our perceptions of the millions of people that have come to Christ over the years and over the generations, is that for God, it's only a remnant. It's only a very, very few compared to the masses of people that will reject Christ. And so when he gets to this point, he says, "Unless the Lord Almighty had left us a descendant," unless God intervened and left descendants for them, "we would have become like Sodom and we would have become like Gomorrah." Now, I don't know if you're familiar with that story. Most of us probably are. But the reason he makes this reference is that if you want to understand God's wrath and that God's against somebody and yet God's mercy, this is the story he picks. Now, Sodom and Gomorrah is where Lot went when he separated from Abraham. He went down to the lush, fertile fields and valleys of Sodom and Gomorrah, and that's where he made his living. But the problem is, it became exceedingly sinful. They indulged in every kind of human sin that you could imagine, and there was no boundaries on their moral conduct. And so God comes to Abraham, and there's three of them. There's two angels and probably a theophany, a presence of the Lord. And God reveals to Abraham what he's going to do. He tells them that I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because they are so exceedingly wicked that in a sense it's like I've come to the end of my rope. This is done. There's no recovery here. And Abraham goes into this debate with God, and he goes, because he knows his nephew's living there. And he goes, "Well, wait a minute, wonder if we could, out of all the people that live there, it's well populated, we could find 50 people that are righteous. Would you spare the whole city if we could find 50? And God goes, "Sure." And Abraham goes, "Wait a minute, he answered that way too quickly. I'm filling that gap in there. I don't know if he actually said that," but God's response probably left him going, "That's probably too high." So he says, "Well, how about 45? Wonder if we can't find 45 people. God says, "Sure, find 45 people, I'll spare the city, the whole city." Abraham's going, he's answering way too quickly. This is not going well. So he backs it up and he says, "Wonder if we could find 40? And God says, "Fine, if you can find 40 people, we're good. So Abraham pushes the envelope again. He says, well, you know, I hate to like keep bringing this up. I mean, if you read it, he's literally almost embarrassed to bring this up with the Lord. He goes, "What? Well, how about 30? Like, you know, wonder if we can find 30 people that are righteous." And God goes, fine, find 30 people and I will spare. So Abraham's going like, this is not working. I mean, he's got two whole cities down there and he's asking for 30 people and God's going, fine, I'll spare it if you can find 30 people. So he whittles God down to 10 people. He says, surely, God, if we could find 10 people, you'll spare both cities, you will spare them. God says, fine. Well, if you know the story, I think Abraham gets a little discouraged because he feels like, wait a minute, we've got two fully populated cities here and God will spare if he can find 10, but this doesn't sound like that's where it's going. The angels go down into the city and they meet Lot, and there's some crazy things that go on there. And Lot houses these two angels or these two men in his home, and the city people are trying to press in to violate the family and do evil things. And the angels blind the people, so they're groping around and temporarily put them at bay. And then in the morning, we're read in Genesis 19:16, it says, when he, Lot, and the only people that are left is Lot, his wife, and his two daughters. They were to get married to two other men, and they went and warned them about this, and they're going like, well, you're just joking. You can't be serious. We're not going to be destroyed. And so that all that's left is Lot, his wife, and the two daughters. Four people in two cities that are righteous enough for God to be merciful. And so as you work through this story, the statement is when he hesitated to leave, because he seemed to be having a hard time buying into this, the men, the angels, grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. And as soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, flee for your lives, don't look back, and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away. And the idea is even in God's mercy, they seemed to be at risk if they weren't responding immediately to what God was trying to do. And you can't help but be somewhat unnerved about it, is that even Lot and his two daughters, and of course we know the story of his wife who got destroyed on the way out because they were told not to look back, only three people in two cities, that's what I would consider a remnant. And so Paul comes to us and he says, listen, there's an urgency here. Needs to be a certain desperation because the extinction of humanity is at stake. That people's lives are doomed for destruction and they're going to perish, and the only hope we have is Jesus Christ. We're not out here trying to win people to a denomination. We're not trying to win people to a religion. We're not trying to build our own sense of identity. God is on a rescue mission to save people from perishing. And yet the struggle for many of us, and I know the struggle for me, is I am not convinced I'm living with that kind of urgency. That sense of desperation that we have no idea when a person's time is up. Whether it's a COVID-19 virus that puts people in the hospital and takes their lives. Whether it's people who lose their job and other circumstances, we have no idea how much life will change and how vulnerable we are in the midst of even global changes. And we have to be reminded that as much as we kind of go, well, there's churches everywhere and there's Christians everywhere, that if we look at this from God's divine perspective, and he looks at all of humanity from time beginning and over 100 billion people have existed, there's only going to be a remnant that are going to be saved. And I would dare say that one of the greatest struggles that I think we have is we're far more worried about our lifestyle than we are about lost people. And I'm not sure how you deal with that other than getting before the throne of grace and asking God to forgive us at times for our indifference and our apathy and our lack of urgency that God has poured out the riches of his glory in the person of his son who sacrificed his life so that we wouldn't just be saved so that we can go do our own thing, but that we might live for Christ, be compelled by his love for a lost world, and find ourselves in a circumstance where he actually uses us to communicate the life-saving rescue of the gospel. God is just not preserving our existence so we have a nice life here. He is not just protecting us so that we can enjoy all the wealth that we have around us. And I know it's a struggle. We've all made decisions that have said, listen, this life and where I'm living and all that goes with it is far more important than what God's called us to do. We've all made those decisions. We've all struggled with what that looks like. But God is preparing us for a new heaven and a new earth. And he will populate it with this remnant of believers, both Jews and Gentiles, as one people of God who will fill this new heaven and new earth with the worship and the praise and the adoration and the glory of Christ and of God himself. And if I can just try to provoke you as believers, do you examine your heart enough to say, God, it's not that we don't have any concern. I'm so impressed by the believers that I hang out with here at Oak Grove Church to hear the stories of them trying to make sacrifices and love people around them and find ways to communicate the gospel. But I know how easy it is for us to be distracted by the things of this life. And I want to just encourage you to remind yourselves, we're called to be ambassadors for Christ, witnesses of the Savior of the world. And God can use any of us if we're willing to trust him and the power of the gospel. If you're listening to us online this morning, I want to encourage you, if you don't know Christ or you're not sure about your relationship with Christ, I want to challenge you to the fact that often the gospel sounds like fiction to those who don't understand it. They said, how is the belief that I have is that I think I'm basically good enough, and when I die, if God's really a God of love, I'll get to heaven. But the truth is, that's the fiction, and as far as God is concerned, the thing that sounds like fiction to you is the reality that he's working from. It's the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I would say, just like Lord Byron's statement, the moral compass, if the Spirit of God is speaking to you now and you feel this great contrast and conflict in your own soul about maybe the fiction and the beliefs that you have, and the Spirit of God is trying to say, that's not the reality that God is working from. He's working from the reality that unless you believe in Jesus, you will never become part of the remnant. You'll never see this new heaven and new earth. You'll never be part of that new community. And I just want to plead with you the simple verse of John 3:16, which I mentioned earlier. For God so loved you. God didn't come to send his son to condemn you. We're all condemned already. But he so loved you that he was willing to sacrifice what is most precious to himself, his son, in order that you might step into life by receiving Christ into your life, asking God to forgive you, and he'll make you a child of God so that now you can live in the community of faith and in fellowship with a risen Savior and honor him not only in this life, but become part of the remnant that will be part of this new heaven and new earth when God sets everything right.